Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Good afternoon, everybody. It is the Steve Jones Show on a Tuesday afternoon. News Radio 1070 WKOK. Matt Catrillo here with you, filling in for Sean Carey once again. Sean will be back on the show later this week. No show tomorrow afternoon, Steve, as we got the Phillies, and we have a packed show today once again.
Yeah, we do have a packed show. Reed Forgrave, CBS Sports, is going to join us. We'll have on the show today Dieter Kurtenbach, San Jose Mercury News on the NBA Finals. Neil Coulon on the show today, and we're also going to have a writer on today from MLive.com on the Juwan Howard hiring at Michigan. Also, Kevin Warren is now the new commissioner. Well, he'll become the commissioner of the Big Ten on January 1st. Jim Delaney was going to originally step aside June 30th of next year. It'll now be January 1st. Kevin Warren, who's been the chief operating officer of the Minnesota Vikings for the past 14 seasons, and had a lot to do with how the funding the Vikings were able to get to build their dome stadium that just hosted the Super Bowl in the Final Four. The Eagles, of course, have a fondness for it there. That's where they won their Super Bowl. He had a lot to do with the funding for that, to make that happen in Minneapolis. He is going to take over as the Big Ten commissioner January 1. He will officially join the Big Ten and leave the Vikings September 16th. So we have a lot of news going on there, which we'll get into in a bit. And the NBA Finals we'll talk about. And the Phillies will play the Padres tonight. And then the Phillies play the Padres tomorrow afternoon. So there's no show tomorrow. Stop with the applause. Okay, put the hands back on the wheel there on Route 15. Okay, it's a busy road. Okay, don't applaud that there's no show tomorrow. Come on. Hey, Matt, that stuff bothers me.
Clearly.
I mean, it's like, you know, it just bothers me. It just does. I mean, there's no show tomorrow. Yeah, okay, great. It's like, you know, it's good. You know, we want the suit. All right, what? spoken out of the mouth of Suit Light. All right, so a little prejudice there, I think. That's what I think. But that's what's been going on. And we're going to talk to Reed Forgrave of CBS Sports in just a few moments. I think, well, we have 10 minutes with him today, Matt? Sounds about right.
We do. Yeah, he's going to be out by a little bit before 3:30. So about 10 minutes today.
Yeah, well, about 10 minutes with him, and then more with Dieter Kurtenbach. I can tell you, our conversations with Dieter are always animated, as are the conversations with Neil Coulon. There's a lot to talk about with the NFL. Do you cut back on preseason games? Do you go to an 18-game schedule? Do you add one more team to the playoffs? We'll talk about that with him coming up as well. All right, we'll take a break. Reed Forgrave, CBS Sports, in just a few moments as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors. Great to have you with us on the show today. Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Very pleased to be joined by Reed Forgrave from CBS Sports. Reed, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you with us.
How's it going in my home state of Pennsylvania?
I know. You're back home again, man. Everything's going well here. We got to get you back in the
state. I
mean, we got to get you back in the state, though.
All my high school friends went to Penn State, so I've spent many a not quite sober night at in State College, and that is one of my favorite campuses in the country.
I'm glad to hear that. People love hearing that when you say that. All right, I got to ask you now about this NBA final that's going on right now. For some odd reason, it's only a personal opinion, so, I mean, if you have a different opinion, please just say so right away. But so far, it feels like it's regular season games in February and not an NBA final, at least so far, to me.
Really? Really? I mean, maybe it's because I was, like, in the moment in Toronto, right? And you never know what comes through on TV and what doesn't. But it felt like this is the biggest event that's happened to Canada since, like, its independence. Like, the feeling outside the stadium where people are, you know, 8 hours before the game, they're lining up around Scotiabank Arena. The whole city, like, grandma on the airplane being like, oh, these Raptors, you know, I don't follow basketball, but boy, I'm so excited about it. Like, they're just all over town. Everyone's just, like, going gaga over Kawhi, and, you know, we need to make him stay. Maybe it's just because I've fallen in love with Toronto as a city over the past week, but it's been high drama, and the fact that the Warriors are at this point that they're at where, I mean, look, they're still the Warriors. I'd still say they're favored in the series, but they're kind of on the ropes, you know, with all these injuries they have. Like, who knows when Kevin Durant, or if Kevin Durant comes back, who knows when Klay Thompson comes back and how good he's going to be. Like, this, I do think, I know that 1 year with Cleveland where they, you know, blew a 3-1 lead, that year was like a complete anomaly, right? But this year feels like their most legit challenge for the Warriors during their entire 5-year run. That, what happened with Draymond in that Cleveland series, him getting the technical, and then like the Cavs building off that and winning 3 in a row, that was such a fluke, right? Cavs still didn't do it. They're still the best player on earth. But this one feels like a very, very real threat to the Warriors' dominance.
So let's get to the Kawhi Leonard part, a stage that he has thrived on before as a former playoff MVP. How difficult is it for Golden State to match up with him, especially if Klay Thompson, who is a fabulous defender, can't go?
I mean, it's close to impossible, you know? Like, Kawhi has been... The past 2 years have been just bizarro world for Kawhi Leonard. At the beginning of last season, he was everybody's chic pick to be the MVP. Then he has that bizarre injury and misdiagnosis and all the drama with the Spurs and kind of forces his way out of town. I'd wipe that year off the books. And then I look at this year, he only played 60 games during the regular season, clearly wasn't trying his hardest. But what we've seen during the playoffs, I think, is the true Kawhi Leonard. And how can you look at these playoffs and say anything other than, at the very least, Kawhi Leonard needs to be in the conversation as the best basketball player on earth, if not anointed the best basketball player? He's been amazing. Yeah.
Yes. No, exactly right. I remember watching him in college at San Diego State because Penn State was in the same bracket they were in the NCAA tournament out in Tucson. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, they could have announced outside that there was an invasion. He'd be like, all right, really? They want to go to the game? He's the coolest cat out there.
he's a wild character, right? Like, just the fact that we saw that one outburst of emotion from him when he hit that shot against Philly. but, like, other than that, like, anything can happen to him, and he's just unflappable. And that personality is the personality this entire team has taken on. Nick Nurse is just cool as a cucumber as a head coach. Kyle Lowry, Fred VanVleet, all these guys. And I think that's one secret to their success, because there have been times during this postseason, specifically in that Sixers series, also in that Bucks series, where it looked like the Raptors were, you know, close to toast. I think this team's awesome. I think I know that there's all these dumb stories in the U.S. about, like, oh, finals ratings are down, worse than 10 years. I'm like, you idiots, it's because those ratings don't include all these people north of the border. You're going crazy over it.
Right. Toronto doesn't count in the ratings in the Nielsen's. They don't count. So, I mean, a lot of people don't realize that. It's like it's not a metered market for the United States.
Something like a third of the people in Canada watched Game 2. A third of the people. I know it's a small country, but my goodness, that's Super Bowl-ish numbers.
Right, that's remarkable. I want to ask you about Kyle Lowry. Obviously, when he plays well, it's a huge plus, but he's found himself in foul trouble in this series, and he's found himself in foul trouble in a couple of other playoff games. Why?
He makes some silly plays like that. I can't remember if it was his fifth foul or his sixth foul that he made in game two, but it was like this frustration foul. He just kind of like reached in on in transition where he had like no chance to get a steal. I don't know why he does it. Like Kyle Lowry, that dude has more guts and more courage than just about anyone out there. He'll step in front of anybody. Like Zion Williamson could be charging a lane, and Kyle Lowry could just appear and be like, "Cool, man, I'll take this one for the team." But I think they're, you know, part of that is taking a risk. Block charges are 50-50 plays, and a lot of times they're among the hardest calls for refs to make. Guy's got to have his feet set and make sure he's not in the restricted area. It's very much a judgment call. So I think that's part of it. Part of it is just he's playing aggressively, and I think that's something that we've seen from Kyle his whole career, that he can be a little bit inconsistent as far as that goes. It's not a knock on him. It's like his greatest characteristic is that he goes all out and that he's such a winner, but sometimes it can almost be like he goes too all out and can end up losing his focus in the long run. And, you know, we can look at his, you know, the foul trouble this series and a little bit earlier in the playoffs, and we can look at his, frankly, offensive numbers this series and be like, oh, Kyle's having a terrible series. But I don't think the straight box scores ever tell you the true contribution of someone like Kyle Lowry. Like, the dude, if there was a stat for winning plays, he'd be in the top five in the NBA every single year.
In fact, he has taken 16 charges in the playoffs so far. That's number one by a wide margin.
Isn't it? I love it.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. In the Milwaukee series, Toronto brilliantly built a wall in the lane, and Giannis could not penetrate the wall. I mean, or he couldn't finish effectively because of it. Defensively, it's a different challenge with Golden State. Why has Toronto been effective defensively against Golden State?
Yeah, effective except in that third quarter.
The 18-0 run, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we're being honest, part of it is because the Warriors haven't been whole yet, and like we'll see if with a healthy Kevin Durant and a healthy Klay Thompson, can the Raptors, on the final stage, can they actually do what they've done against the Warriors? I tend to doubt it. And I tend to doubt the Raptors have that much of a chance to win this series if those guys come back perfectly healthy. But I think the chance of them coming back perfectly healthy probably isn't that great. I think part of it is just like this is, they've kept the Warriors mostly out of transition. At least in game one, they did not turn the ball over that much. The Raptors didn't. And that helped them get back on defense. And I think that's huge for them because they have such a good half-court defense. They just throttle people. They choke you out in the half-court. Yeah. They're so smart, and there's bodies flying everywhere. And they're great at, like, I don't even know how to describe this. It's like they can double-team someone without giving up the open man. They're so quick to recover, so good in their rotations. I just think it's a really, really smart defense with a lot of size and athleticism. But like Marc Gasol, he's the smartest defender on the planet. Yeah. He's the quarterback of that defense.
I feel like they're playing like a version of Virginia's pack line defense where they can recover and come back out. Right.
I love that. That's actually a great analogy that I might steal from you and use.
Steal it. Go for it and take full credit. I know I only have time probably for one more question with you. It's going to be about Draymond Green. Throughout the playoffs, game one aside, but throughout the playoffs, have you seen a maturity in Draymond Green's approach and also how he sees the floor?
I mean, absolutely. And I think you can stretch that, you know, further back than just the playoffs. I think the fact that he put himself on this crash diet in the middle of winter and lost 20 or 25 pounds is the reason that he's been an elite player these playoffs. I know the box scores with Draymond are always weird as well, just like with Kyle Lowry, but like he's been awesome defensively, and he's been kind of the fulcrum of that offense. So I think it kind of starts with that. And then, you know, the second part is, like, Draymond's always going to be an emotional player. Someone asked him the other day if he was
sure.
if he'd ever be like Kawhi Leonard, right? And he's like, no. He's like, what are you talking about? He's always, that's part of his greatness, is that he plays with emotion and with fury. And sometimes when that emotion and fury isn't there, like it wasn't at the beginning of game one, the Warriors can follow, and they can just be kind of an emotionless team that lacks its heart. So Draymond, I think, has to keep some of that sort of the kind of craziness, I guess. But the dude is such – he's always been such a high IQ basketball player. I think he's one of the smartest players in the yes. entire game, yes. on court and off, by the way. I think he's brilliant. I think he's a genius. But the fact that he has been able to be a leader, keep his emotions in check, even though not hiding them, it's impressive. I think he's matured light years. I don't think it's – coincidence he's got a contract coming up in a year and a half, but yeah, man, I want that guy on my side, right? No matter what yeah. sport I'm playing, that's a dude you want on your side.
No question. Hey, we're glad you're on our side today. Appreciate it so much to have you. Always great talking with you, Reed.
All right, enjoy it. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, all right, Reed Forgrave, CBS Sports, on the NBA Finals. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll talk with Neil Kulong. We'll get into a little football, talk about the NFL. There's also been, we talked about the new commissioner of the Big Ten, which will be Kevin Warren. What will happen now, instead of Jim Delaney stepping down June 30th next year, he will step down on January 1, 30 years. And Kevin Warren will become the sixth commissioner of the league. Now, he's going to start his job September 16th. And that way he can get into the transition alongside Delaney. What Kevin Warren is going to inherit, he is going to inherit a situation where all the parts are in place and he doesn't have to take immediate action on anything right away. The TV deals are in place till 2022. Now, in 21, you want to start laying the groundwork. But in 20, he won't have to do anything except stay in touch with everybody. But the TV contracts will be up in 22. So in 21, he can lay the groundwork, and then he can negotiate. All the bowl deals are in place. That was the other announcement that they made today in the Big Ten. Starting in 2020, the Holiday Bowl will be out. So the Holiday Bowl gets one last go-around in the Big Ten. All right, that's this year. Then starting next year, these are all six-year deals that run through 2025. The Rose Bowl already ran through 25. The Orange Bowl already ran through 25, so those are already done. The Citrus Bowl, Outback Bowl, Las Vegas Bowl, Music City Bowl, okay, the Cheez-It Bowl, the Red Box Bowl, and the Quick Lane Bowl all go out to 2025. The Pinstripe Bowl is going to run out in 21. They extended that to 2025. And the Las Vegas Bowl and the Belk Bowl will be two new bowls for the Big Ten to be involved in Charlotte for the Belk Bowl and the Las Vegas Bowl. Oh, voila, in Las Vegas at the brand-new Raiders Stadium. They'll all run through 2025 as well. So Kevin Warren's going to inherit a situation where the TV deals are in place and the bowl deals were in place, and he can transition into the job, and then the heavy lifting can really start at that point. He's also inheriting a job where right now each school reportedly got $54 million last year from all their deals. Neil Kulong, next half hour, as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. In a few moments, Neil Kulong will talk about the NFL. Next half hour, Dieter Kurtenbach from the San Jose Mercury News. Kevin Franzen on the Phillies in the final half hour. So big show today. Very busy. With that, we bring in Neil Coulong. Last week we hung up on him. That's never going to happen again. We got him the first time through. Neil, welcome.
It's good to be here. First connection, first time. This is good.
Long time listener, first time caller.
What do you think about that? I always ask radio people that. What's your reaction to people that call in with that?
It's neat that they felt compelled to call, unless they think I'm stupid. I hate what you said. I'm calling in first time. Oh, look, my son always has this running joke. He says, long time Boston radio, long time listener, first time caller. Brady, best ever? Really? That's why you called?
Cincy from Revere. Just want to know what your thoughts on Brady are.
I'm calling from Somerville. When's Boy B.U.'s birthday? All right. Roger Goodell says 4 preseason games not necessary. That's, of course, unless you have the season ticket package. This is not an unusual thing. It has come up before. So let's start with a couple things. What do you think, idealistically, Neil, would be the proper number of preseason games where you feel like when you're done with it, you're ready to start playing games?
I think it really depends on how teams approach their preseason. I mean, there are some, and that's almost kind of a year-to-year thing, that there are some teams that want to get legitimate reps and looks at guys that could make their roster, that might make their roster, that might be a practice squad kind of guy. There are those kinds of tryouts in games. And I'm not saying that they necessarily need to have 4, but I'm also saying they don't necessarily need to have 2. We don't know what the exact amount is.
Right.
And I think that's going to change. I think the issue that Goodell and company really want to examine is how much they're charging for those preseason games.
That's my point.
That's the issue from the fans' perspective.
Yes.
More than anything. I think they'd sell out if they went for, you know, $5 a seat. Mm-hmm. They get a lot more people in to look at it. From the players' perspective, obviously, this is a much different conversation than it is for the owners or for the fans. Should they be out there playing? I'm talking about the star players, you know, guys that don't necessarily need to be out there. They're risking injury. We'll see 1 or 2 season-ending injuries in the preseason. We always do. It's unfortunate that that happens. I'm of the belief that that same injury could happen in training camp just as easily as it can in the preseason game itself. You can't avoid the risk of the game. Something's going to happen. So
right.
to whatever degree they can collectively bargain what that right amount is, I think the owners are up for, as long as they're receiving whatever compensation that they're used to getting with that. In other words, this is a huge bargaining chip for the league. They're willing to take a look at the amount of preseason games they have to play if the players are willing to deal on something else. And the obvious thing is, well, why don't we make it an 18-game season?
That's my next question.
I'm not necessarily in favor of that either. I think, though, from the owner's perspective, the topic itself, if Goodell is saying we're willing to play ball when it comes to lowering the amount of preseason games, that's kind of a divide-and-conquer move, because the majority of the union are made up of guys that might need a couple extra looks. So more preseason games helps them out, if not for the team that they're currently on and another team that might be watching film looking for another receiver that's going to get cut. Those types of players might need more exposure, but clearly they don't have the voice in the union that the
right.
top-level players do. They're the ones who are bringing in the money that pays the guys that make these decisions. So for me, I think it's more political than anything else. I don't think the owners care, because the one thing that the players aren't going to be able to control is how much they're charging for preseason games anyway. So I don't think it makes much of a difference to them. If they get 2 more regular season games, I don't think the owners would mind a whole lot. I don't think that's good for the game. I certainly don't think it's good for the players. But, you know, Goodell gets to walk out of there thinking that he's, you know, progressive and you know, trying to make a stand in favor of wear and tear on the players' bodies by taking away 2 preseason games, even as silly as that is.
How valuable are scrimmages versus preseason games? When they have those scrimmages, like, for example, the Steelers will scrimmage the Redskins, what's the value to you of a scrimmage, controlled scrimmage versus a preseason game?
I think it's a really interesting question. It's one that you don't get a real answer to, because there are a lot of coaches, a lot of, not the players as much, but a lot of coaches, even the lower-level guys, the scouts will say it a lot too, They like the controlled environment. They like being able to work on situational stuff with a level of competition that they're not going to get banging heads against the same guys every single day. If just a team off the top of my head, the Chiefs were to come to Latrobe to scrimmage the Steelers, usually it's in front of a preseason game that they'll play. The work that they get in is that week. You know, the drills and everything. It's the sense of camaraderie that builds. You're actually going up against other guys. It gives a lot of guys better look. You know, they get more out of it overall. Most of the coaches, though, aren't going to say that on the record, but the ones that I've spoken to, and it's been a few of them, they prefer a scrimmage kind of environment like that in camp because it's more simulated. They can control more. They don't have to play a bunch of meaningless snaps that they don't really need, and they can get the work in that they want to get, and they can get looks at guys in the specific controlled situations that may not come up in a game. You know, it's possible. You never have a third and three situation during a preseason game, so you don't know how this running back is going to look. You're able to do 7 or 8 reps in a row of that kind of a situation against another NFL caliber team, or at least against guys that are also competing for spots. And you get basically the intensity of a game without all the fanfare that comes with it. It leads into a game that ultimately doesn't matter. But for me, I think this is never going to happen, I'm sure. If they were to charge for those kinds of scrimmages, to do drills in a controlled environment with some fan-friendly kind of stuff worked in, I think a team could get some revenue out of that. I think a reasonable person would pay $5, maybe $10 to go to that kind of a scrimmage if it's closed, if it's in, you know, the non-NFL, corporatized sort of environment. If you're out in Latrobe, if you're in a different environment and you're seeing everybody that's out there, and it's done not entirely for the fans, but you're seeing NFL level competition. The top guys are going however long they're going to go. Right. I think more people would be interested in something like that than they will the pomp and circumstance of a preseason game as we know now.
And guess what? You're a $15 billion business, right? And by the way, $15 billion and going higher. You charge $5 per, you close it, and guess what? You take the money and give it to NFL charities.
Yeah.
Now you look good for doing it.
Exactly. That's exactly it. They can do more. Trying to put this in the most appropriate way that doesn't make me sound like I'm all about giving away other people's money, but you can earn more by things other than just profit. You know, the goodwill in the community. Building up that fan base, the future fan base. If you're catering it to kids, they're going to want to be involved in your product. You know, you're building out a future audience, and it's not like you're giving it away either. You're earning the money. You're bringing in something that, you know, you're going to do anyway. Just add a little bit to it for one of those days out of the week. People are going to pay to come and see it. Make it fun. Make it something of a rivalry. Players can do stuff for charity while they're there as well. Hey, even, heaven forbid, they can wear whatever cleats they want.
Sure.
You know, you can do all kinds of stuff with this.
Yes.
It's there for the taking if the NFL would take on a more progressive approach to what they do, but I don't think they're at the point where they're willing to do those kinds of things. But it's a shame. They shouldn't be talking about getting rid of two meaningless preseason games. They should be finding ways to maybe not reinvent their product, but reach, different audiences in different ways, stuff that they haven't quite done before, they haven't tried before.
The 18-game schedule would be one that the players would balk at because they would, we're playing two more regular season games, we want more money. That will be obviously the argument in this that has to be negotiated moving forward. Now there's another part to this. There is, once again, the possibility of expanding the playoffs by one more team and only having one team have a first-round bye. Now, this is, again, these are proposals. I throw that proposal out on the table. What say you?
I think it's good to always reevaluate what you're doing. If you think about it, having two teams with byes is a little odd. It's a little awkward. The difference between the second seed and the third seed most often isn't a whole lot anyway. So the difference between the first and the third probably isn't all that much. Having one team, having teams have to fight longer into the season to get that, coveted week off, I think it might create a little bit more of an advantage for that one team. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think there are a lot of teams that are playing pretty good football toward the end of the year, and putting more of them into the playoffs creates, more of a true sense of who the best team really is. Right. There are teams that finish 8-8 in the season that played really well over the last 5-6 games. Mm-hmm. You know, I look back to the Steelers in 2013. I don't think anybody would have wanted to play them in the playoffs, and they narrowly missed the most impossible playoff situation I think the Steelers would have ever had had they got in. They would have been tough to beat. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Chargers, who got that last seed at 8-8 in the playoffs, I think they won their first game. So I mean, you have teams that are so close in that middle range. Expanding it, I think, can create a little bit more excitement. But I also do believe that it should be limited. I mean, the NHL, it's not so much that you got into the playoffs, it's that you're terrible that you didn't get into the playoffs.
Yes.
I don't want to create that sort of mentality either. A good example, I think, is baseball. I think the weirdness of what they're doing with the one-and-in setup that's largely determined 2.5 weeks ahead of time. There isn't the drama and suspense that they want to have with it. But I think if you were to set up a playoff format in which you see teams that really are playing the best, because you don't see teams that start 0-8 and win their last 8 games. That doesn't happen. But you do have teams that start off 4-6 that end up playing really well down the stretch. They finish 9-7 and miss out on a tiebreaker. Right? 16 games in a season might not be quite enough to say these are the best teams come January. I think maybe another playoff game, not a regular season game, but adding another playoff game includes more of the teams that you would want to see more often than it would the 9-7 team that finished seventh in a bad conference that year. I don't think that situation would come up as often.
Which then brings, I believe, it's the Kansas City Chiefs proposal, and their proposal is to reseed. In other words, instead of having the first 4 seeds be all the division champs, now the division champs, yeah, you're in, but when it comes to seeding 1-6, it's done by record. What's your thought on that?
I don't really see an advantage either way. I like the idea of putting the weight into the division, which is what the NFL really wanted to do when it expanded and then equaled out as well as they could, at least geographically, all the divisions, and then had them all have 4 teams and mandate that they all play each divisional opponent twice in a year. I think the purpose for that is to enhance the rivalry aspect of the NFL, which is really regular season playoff games. You know, needless to say, Steelers versus Ravens, maybe not as hot today as it was, but back in the day, that was bigger than a playoff game. You know, those were nasty rivalry games that determined the playoffs in many ways in the AFC. They want to hang on to that as much as they can to have those built-in, you know, playoff-level kinds of matchups, especially toward the end of the season. I think keeping the division the priority, I think that makes more sense. I don't think it's really all that valid to say that it's going to be often where a team that goes, you know, there's going to be the first place team in the division goes 15-1, the second place team goes 13-3. So the 13-3 team has to go play on the road in the first round of the playoffs. I don't think that's really all that common. I don't think it's all that big of a deal.
Right.
Most teams that make the playoffs are pretty good, and usually the division winner is better than most of the, you know, than at least one of the wild card teams.
Mm-hmm.
Reseeding it, I don't think solves anything. I don't think it really changes much. I don't really see it as being that big of a problem, I guess, overall. I can see it from the Chiefs' perspective. You've had a lot of power in the AFC West lately. I can understand where they're coming from, but over the long haul, I don't think it really matters. I would just keep I would rather just the divisions be the you know, the kingpin of the whole season.
Well, it's the first week of June, and we had a lot to talk about. Appreciate it so much. Great, as always, my friend.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
You know, the Phillies have not been shy about sending their first-round pick to Williamsport. And guess what? The door might be open for them to do it again. Because their first-round pick is out of UNLV. And he is a shortstop that, you know what, actually might continue to play shortstop, which I find to be very interesting. I mean, he got a good arm, He can play other positions in the infield. Saw some limited time last summer in the Cape Cod League. The only question I would have about the Phillies' first-round pick, and for those who are not sure, it's Bryson Stott from UNLV. Look, he's left-handed, great. Back control, got it. I know the Phillies love his approach to the plate. The question is, okay, and you want to talk about a guy that has a great arm. He's got a great arm, and he's very athletic. So I think that the door could be open to him playing second base or third down the road. Oh, but guess what? I think down the road he may still be a shortstop. Here's the only question I have about him, other than the usual, you know, adjusting to new levels. When you play in the Mountain West Conference, guess what happens to the baseball when you hit it? It flies. And you're just not sure whether whatever power he showed at UNLV, we just won't know how it translates until we start seeing him in the minor leagues. Was he the beneficiary of Mountain West thin air, which is the story of the Mountain West Conference? Or is he the beneficiary of the fact that he's got a really good swing, and guess what? It translates no matter where you're playing. That'll be the question. Can't answer that until he starts playing games. And you know what? College player. And the Phillies have not been shy the last couple of years about sending their first-round pick, if it's a college player, to Williamsport. Now, same thing with the Spikes. They don't seem to see what the Cardinals want to do with Zach Thompson from Kentucky. First-round pick. Same story. Lefty out of Kentucky. He also pitched in the Cape Cod League last summer. 6'3", four-pitch guy, changeup, throws slider, curveball, fastball. He has not had injuries at Kentucky, but he had injuries earlier in his career, including a shoulder trouble in high school. In fact, I believe the Rays drafted him in 16. He failed the physical. Well, it's not going to happen now, but could he possibly, as a first-round pick, be in the New York Penn League and stay college? But Stott, the Phillies have to make a decision, signing him. Then once they sign him, again, they have not been shy about sending their first-round pick to Williamsport. Just brought that up from the draft. That would be an interesting point to make, especially locally. You got to take the draft stuff. So, I mean, we could talk about the draft pick of Stott there just as a future player. Now you got to localize it. Well, maybe it means something for us here in our area. We might see him. Pirates picked another high school pitcher. They have had a very mixed bag when it comes to picking high school pitchers high. Very mixed bag. Orioles got one of the top players in the draft, the catcher out of Oregon State, right out of the gate. And the draft is flying along now. The draft is through round 5. It's the second day of it. They'll take it to round 10 today, and then rounds 11 through 40 will be tomorrow, which means it's going to be rapid fire. In fact, looks like the Dodgers just picked Matt Cotrillo. So I'm not saying it's an exact science as to how they're doing it.